Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Connecticut's primary wrapped up last night with a surprising upset in the three-way Republican race for U.S. Senate. You can listen to coverage on Connecticut Public throughout the day and online at ctpublic.org. And coming up tomorrow, we'll have more analysis of the election where we live. Today, we focus on new research from multiple studies highlighted recently at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in San Diego. Studies show high blood pressure during pregnancy, consumption of highly processed foods, and the loss of smell are all predictors of cognitive decline. Coming up, we talk to Dr. Amy Sanders, medical director of the Hartford Healthcare Memory Care Center. And later, Dr. Carl Hill from the Alzheimer's Association talks to us about new research on how experiencing discrimination and racism increases the risk of memory loss. Now, are you or someone in your family impacted by Alzheimer's? You can join us, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Nationally, two-thirds of women have Alzheimer's, and two-thirds of women are caregivers for someone who has the disease. There are 6 million Americans living with Alzheimer's. That's according to the latest figures from the Alzheimer's Association. And in Connecticut, that's 80,000 people. Joining me first is a Connecticut couple from Milford. On Zoom with us, Sandy and George Carlino. George has early stage Alzheimer's and is in an Eli Lilly clinical trial in New Haven. Sandy and George, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
George, my producer tells me that you turned 69 this week. A happy early birthday, I hope.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourselves. I'll start with you, George. I mentioned that you live in Milford. So tell us about your life there and what you did as a career.
I used to be a CNC machinist for a manufacturing company for aerospace. Then things started going a little bit awry for me, and I had to pack it in. So trying to deal with everything and just do the best I can. Mm-hmm.
Sandy, George had mentioned that things started to go a little awry. So can you describe when you and your husband noticed that something was wrong and then you went to the doctors to find out?
I'd say from about 2015 onward, he really displayed a lot of memory issues. He complained a lot about not being able to stay awake. He would just forget things. I would tell him something and he would completely forget about it. As an example, I'd try and tell him dinner's gonna be ready in 5 minutes. Okay, he would literally leave or go somewhere else and completely forget. So just weird things. And he fell asleep driving home he kind of fought going to a doctor. He didn't think anything was wrong. I finally made an appointment with a neurologist and he agreed to go. And on his way home to get ready to go to the neurologist appointment, he fell asleep driving and got in a minor accident. No one was hurt or anything, but that was actually the last day he worked. Mm. From that point forward, it's been an adventure.
That must have been so frightening when you heard about that accident, Sandy. And so when was George diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's?
It was, around May of 2019, April, May timeframe. Mm-hmm. And we were very lucky. The neurologist immediately referred us to clinical trial and asked if we were interested. And that's what we've been doing ever since. Mm-hmm.
And George, how are you doing today?
Doing okay. A little tired, but I'm fine.
Do you have children and grandchildren nearby?
Yeah.
Well, that's good to have relatives around.
We have a few of them in the house with us right now.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Lisa. Yeah.
So you have good support from family. Sandy, you'd mentioned that George was immediately enrolled in the clinical trial. My understanding is that was suddenly stopped. What happened there?
It was Biogen trial. And As I understand, the FDA had approved one Biogen Alzheimer's drug, and just a few months later, Biogen stopped this other study for a different drug. I'm assuming it was because the other drug had been approved and they were going to concentrate on that instead. I think also they were getting not great results, just kind of middle of the road results from the trial that he was on.
You're hearing Sandy and George Carlino, who live in Milford, as we talk about Alzheimer's, including a new research that was highlighted at the International Alzheimer's Association in a conference in San Diego recently. I wanted to bring into our conversation Dr. Amy Sanders, who's medical director of the Hartford Healthcare Memory Care Center, also a medical scientific advisory council member at the Alzheimer's Association Connecticut chapter. Dr. Sanders, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we heard a little bit from Sandy and George, including this clinical trial that they referred to that was suddenly stopped. Is that a common struggle for Alzheimer's patients and families when a clinical trial is suddenly stopped? And what should the patient do to help find maybe a different trial or treatment?
Well, many times when people are enrolled in a clinical trial, they're enrolled either through a sort of freestanding clinical research organization, and there's a big prominent one in New Haven, or they're enrolled under the auspices of an Alzheimer's disease research center, such as is findable at Yale. And many times if an organization is involved in clinical trials, they are involved in more than one. If somebody is in a trial that is suddenly stopped, then you might need, if it's been a pharmaceutical trial, and many of them are, meaning that you're taking a medication, then you might need what's called a washout period. You might need to wait a little between the trial that was stopped and being enrolled in a new trial. And then each clinical trial has its own set of inclusion and exclusion criteria that any hopeful enrollee would have to meet.
Right. So Sandy and George, I understand now George is enrolled in the Eli Lilly clinical trial in New Haven. So can you tell us a little bit about that, Sandy?
Sure. It is, the name is Trailblazer. I know it is, I actually have it in front of me. Donanemab, it's phase 3. And I can tell you that it's a world of difference between the Biogen trial and the Trailblazer trial. And both trials are double-blind studies, so you don't know whether you're on the drug or not. However, since he's been on the Trailblazer trial, he's changed incredibly. He's kind of coming back to who he used to be. He would have the sundowning and go through all of these trials and tribulations, and we actually referred to our life as a combination of 51st dates and Groundhog Day. And that's the truth. And he's just changed immensely. He's much more in control. He can actually kind of feel when he's starting to go into a downward spiral, and he's developed a lot of tools for himself to kind of stop himself from doing it. And he communicates with me. Right. Which is the most important thing.
And George, tell us how you have noticed your difference now that you're in this trial.
I do have a little bit more energy to get outside now, especially when it's sunny. And I just putter around the yard and do things. And it does help, because before that, I would be staying in the house just about 24/7 doing nothing.
Just staring into space.
Yeah. Or just watch TV, just being a vegetable, so to speak.
So it sounds like this clinical trial, it's really given you a lot of hope.
I believe so. Believe so. And hopefully, you know, it's going to help a lot of other people.
Sandy earlier used the term sundowning, which I know some listeners have heard of and know about it. But can you describe when that has happened to you, you know, how you're feeling and Sandy, what you observe?
it's not fun at all. He just literally goes inside himself, and you'd really have to see it to understand it. But he gets very cold, like in a heat wave. He's got socks on and sweaters and long pants and blankets, and it just like grabs him and takes him down a rabbit hole where he will not communicate. I'll ask him, "Are you okay?" "I'm fine." That kind of thing. So we've learned now. Thank God it doesn't happen as often as it did, because it really was daily, and you could almost set your clock to it. It would be with him, it'd be like early afternoon ish. But now he actually is saying, you know, I think something's happening. So what he does now is he tells me that, and then I get him another blanket and he goes to sleep. Mm-hmm. And then when he wakes up, don't you agree? He's so much better. He's back to normal. So I'm grateful.
Yeah. George, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, when it starts with me, it for some reason, my toes get cold. And then it's like a negative energy that is starting to penetrate up through my body. And that's when, you know, something has to be done. It's like, whether just going, you know, into, you know, just go to sleep. I've been taking walks more, you know, just around the neighborhood. You know, I don't go too far. But, the bad thing was, is that, you know, when I wasn't communicating with Sandy, she couldn't figure anything out. Because I can't figure anything out. I don't really know what was happening to me. Mm. So it's trial and error, but I think we are progressing and trying to figure it out.
One thing that he says every time is that he's scared. He's afraid.
Yeah.
And he feels all alone. He just feels lonely. And he'll say, "I don't understand why I feel lonely. I'm not alone. But this is what's happening to me." So thank God he's communicating it.
Yeah. So I don't know if any other people have that, because, you know, we can't communicate with others that are going through probably the same thing that I am. But we don't have any contacts because of, well,
or when
COVID came in and everything stopped.
Well, Dr. Sanders is still with us from Hartford HealthCare. Did you want to add to the discussion in terms of, you know, describing sundowning and what patients with Alzheimer's experience, Dr. Sanders?
Well, one thing that we know, and certainly that I have experienced in my clinical practice, is that for Alzheimer's disease, there is simply no universal playbook. So the experience that George and Sandy have had with his sundowning is uniquely his. That doesn't mean that other people with Alzheimer's disease don't sundown. They do, but they have their individual versions of how it affects them. And sundowning is a common, although poorly understood, aspect of some of the behavioral and psychiatric side effects of having Alzheimer's disease. And it sounds to me like Sandy and George are superlative observers. And once you can observe what the changes are, then sometimes you can intervene to help improve the situation. And then George has also had the additional possible benefit of being in a clinical trial that has also helped him sort of manage the sundowning better. I mean, so to sleep through it is probably a really good recipe. Not everybody's able to achieve that. So congratulations.
And that's key, Dr. Sanders, and how you described it. When we think about these clinical trials, there is no cure yet for Alzheimer's, but ways to manage some of these symptoms that patients are experiencing, that's the goal?
That is often the goal. And it's in many ways more powerful than any medication that I could prescribe, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say at least as powerful as any of the medications that are being studied in clinical trials. Probably the best approach going forward is having a care partner like Sandy, who is invested and observant in the care team, if you will, of anybody who has Alzheimer's disease. It's the person who's with them and the medication together. That's probably going to be the best way forward.
Sandy, you are George's caregiver, and I wanted to talk with you about that and how you get support and how you've been doing since his diagnosis.
What really gives me my sanity is that I work full time as well. And I work remotely most of the time. And it gives me some space when I have, and some independence when I can go to the office for a while or a day or whatever. It also helps him not be so dependent on me, because that's part of the spiral too. I can't do anything. He's doing a lot and he does a lot. We have a great support network. He has three other brothers, so there were four boys in his family. They all live very close. One of them lives three houses away from us. Our kids, we got lots of grandkids, and everybody is kind and caring, and they love their grandpa and want to do stuff with them. We're very blessed. We live in a nice area, where a smaller area, and all of our neighbors know each other and watch out for each other. So we are blessed. We are very, very blessed. And we do say that daily. So that's about it.
Yeah, it's been good.
And I do have a glass of wine at night.
Yes, definitely. Well, it's been so good to hear from both you and George, sharing your story with us. George, we wish you the best. Thank you so much for your time today on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been hearing Sandy and George Carlino from Milford, Connecticut. Now, I wanted to mention the Connecticut chapter of the Alzheimer's Association offers support to families and caregivers in English and in Spanish from experts in the field of dementia. The Alzheimer's Association has a 24/7 helpline. That's 800-272-3900, 800-272-3900. And there's also more information at alz.org/CT. Staying with us where we live, Dr. Amy Sanders, Medical Director of the Hartford Healthcare Memory Care Center. And we're going to talk more after the break about findings from new research on Alzheimer's and how people can work to prevent cognitive decline. We're here to also help answer your questions as well, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers. So we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're learning about research into Alzheimer's today, highlighting new studies that identify factors that increase the risk of cognitive decline later in life. Now, people are usually diagnosed with Alzheimer's after the age of 65, but there is a younger onset population. And those with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia can live from 2 to 20 years after diagnosis. And dementia is the umbrella term for a set of symptoms, and Alzheimer's causes dementia. Other types of dementia include vascular, Lewy body, and mixed dementia. With us here on Zoom is Dr. Amy Sanders, Director of the Hartford Healthcare, Medical Director of the Hartford Healthcare Memory Care Center, and a Medical Scientific Advisory Council member at the Alzheimer's Association Connecticut chapter. Dr. Sanders, I've mentioned there was a new, yet-to-be-published research that was presented at this International Alzheimer's Association conference in San Diego recently. I wanted to talk with you about some of those studies, and I wanted to begin with the EXERT study, which focused on how exercise, even mild stretching, can prevent or reduce cognitive decline. So can you talk about that study?
I'd be happy to. This is actually one of my favorite studies or sets of results that were announced at the recent conference. So this was a study, a long study, actually, and many times in clinical research, longer is better. Mm-hmm. So they studied older adults who had mild cognitive impairment. Mild cognitive impairment is a condition that sort of lies between normal cognitive aging and a dementia like Alzheimer's disease. Many times we think it's due to underlying Alzheimer's pathology, but many times we think it's not due to underlying Alzheimer's pathology. So it's a very heterogeneous state. And in this study, in the EXERT study, all of the participants had mild cognitive impairment. And then they were assigned randomly to an exercise arm or a just live your life normally, no exercise arm. And what is really great about the findings from this study is that the exercisers, some of them did aerobic exercise and some, you know, fairly strenuous exercise, but others did some stretching. And both active groups did not decline cognitively over the period of the study, which, as I mentioned, was a year. So if you're somebody who has mild cognitive impairment and you can buy yourself a year without any additional cognitive decline, that is some very powerful stuff. So even just light stretching, you don't have to race walk or swim laps and laps and laps. Some light stretching, a little bit of yoga, probably even some chair yoga. The moral of the story is get moving, and that actually can be protective of cognition. Mm. The group who had no physical activity declined significantly over that year-long study period.
I'm glad that you mentioned that we don't have to be out there running laps to help, minimize cognitive decline, that stretching even makes a difference. Something you said earlier when we talk about what you might see in normal aging with memory loss versus if you know it's related to dementia. Can you differentiate those for us, for listeners who might be listening and, you know, might be wondering if there are some signs that they're dealing with something more than just regular aging and cognitive decline?
I would be very happy to, because there are a lot of misconceptions out there in the world about these very questions. Once upon a time, we did consider that memory loss was a normal part of aging. Oh, grandma doesn't know who I am anymore, but that's just because she's old. Now we know better. And memory loss, actual measurable memory loss, is never a component of normal cognitive aging. That said, there are things that happen as a normal part of the aging brain. Probably one that people experience the most is what we call the tip of the tongue phenomenon. Who is that actor Who was the man who beat Billie Jean King in the Battle of the Sexes tennis tournament in the early 1970s? That was one of my famous tip of the tongue phenomena, my own personal one. And if the word that you're looking for, the name that you're looking for, comes back to you more often than not, and not necessarily immediately, sometimes it's seconds, sometimes it's minutes, but it can be hours, days, weeks. I had one recently myself that was months long, and suddenly it just popped into my head one day when I was at work. So that's a tip of the tongue phenomenon. It is aggravating as all get out, but it is not usually pathological. It's benign. Mm-hmm. And many people experience that. In fact, sometimes that's the presenting reason that a patient comes to our clinic. And so then we examine them and we do an assessment. And if everything looks normal, then we can say to them, this is normal cognitive aging. So the tip of the tongue phenomenon, big part of that. Also, it takes longer to learn how to do something new. You can get there in the end. It's just that it's going to take you a little bit longer. And that applies also to things that you already know how to do. So if you're a jigsaw puzzle aficionado, you might not put the puzzles together quite as quickly as you did 10, 15, 20 years ago, but you can still do the puzzle. So sometimes being a little bit slower in learning new information and the tip of the tongue phenomenon, those are two of the big components of normal cognitive aging. Mm. Memory loss is not a component of normal cognitive aging.
Thank you for that explanation. You're hearing Dr. Amy Sanders, Medical Director of the Hartford Healthcare Memory Care Center, as we talk about Alzheimer's and new research about some of the predictors of cognitive decline later in life. If you have a question, you can join us, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Dr. Sanders, we got a question from a listener on Facebook. Maggie writes, I watched my great aunt live for 10 years with Alzheimer's. And I'm wondering, is it genetic? And also, how long on average can people live with Alzheimer's? What can you tell her?
Well, as I said earlier, there is no universal playbook for Alzheimer's disease. So patients frequently ask me, so what's going to happen to me? And my answer to that, and my answer this morning, unfortunately, is that my crystal ball is cloudy. It's very difficult to predict the course of the disease in any given individual. We know that there are things that occur commonly, but just because they occur commonly doesn't mean that they're going to happen to someone's great aunt. So, and as was said earlier, the usual natural history of the disease can be anywhere from 2 to 20 years after diagnosis. So it's hard to predict what is actually going to happen to any one particular individual. Mm.
So if you have relatives in your family that have Alzheimer's or another dementia, when we think about what researchers know and some of the risk factors, working on prevention, that's key?
We are more and more coming to the understanding, the realization that probably preventing Alzheimer's disease is going to be a much better approach than attempting to cure Alzheimer's disease once it has started. And we're really starting to see some powerful and somewhat unexpected research findings coming out that tell us just how far back in life we really need to be thinking about protecting our brains. And the question originally was, is Alzheimer's disease genetic? And there my answer is, well, sort of. Mm-hmm. So early onset Alzheimer's disease sometimes is familial. That, though, tends to be a consequence of somebody in the family having what we call an autosomal dominant genetic mutation. You can think of that as a kind of genetic problem that causes destiny. If you have one of these mutations, you are going to get Alzheimer's disease because they are, as we say in the medical jargon, highly penetrant, which means that if they're present, they show the effect. So if there's a mutation like that in a family, about 50% of the descendants of the first person who had that mutation are going to have Alzheimer's disease. That, however, is a very, very tiny portion of all of the people who have Alzheimer's disease. Mm. There's another genetic risk factor not destiny this time, but just a risk factor that increases vulnerability to developing Alzheimer's disease. And that is called the epsilon allele of the ApoE gene. And if one has one bad copy of the risk allele, so an allele just means that there are different flavors of the genetic code that it can occur at a particular point on a particular gene. And in the ApoE gene, the epsilon allele has three variations. And if you have the bad one, then your risk is increased relative to people who don't have that bad allele, but it's not destiny. And then some people have no risk allele and have no family members who have had an autosomal dominant genetic mutation. And those people just have sort of average risk. So there are some things that enhance your vulnerability to Alzheimer's disease. They can be genetic. And there are things that really are destiny that someone is going to develop Alzheimer's disease. Also genetic, but very rare.
I wanted to get back to some of the other new research that came out at this International Alzheimer's Association conference, Dr. Sanders, including findings on high blood pressure during pregnancy, how that's linked to increased risk of dementia. Can you tell us more there?
This was actually kind of mind-blowing for me. We know that so-called vascular risk factors, including hypertension, high blood pressure, increase the risk of cognitive decline and dementia as one ages. Probably the most common kind of dementia that is out there is actually a mixed dementia, a combination of Alzheimer's disease with vascular disease in the brain. So keeping one's blood sugar, one's cholesterol, one's blood pressure under good control, really powerful protective factors. And here we're seeing in the study about high blood pressure that high blood pressure in pregnancy, even if it is only gestational, meaning only during the pregnancy, is actually a fairly profound risk factor for the development of later cognitive decline and dementia. That is, I'm certainly not omniscient in the world of Alzheimer's research, but that's the first time I've ever heard anything remotely like that. And it really means that women who are of childbearing age are preparing or to have a child or have had children really need to be monitored in a longstanding chronic way for the status of their cognition and to keep their risk factors, their vascular risk factors, under the best control possible, because if they don't, badness ensues, cognitive decline and dementia associated with hypertension during pregnancy.
Yeah, there's definitely a role when we think about prenatal care, but also, as you mentioned, even after a child or children are born, if a woman had a hypertension, that just being monitored through her primary care physician in terms of later decline.
Indeed.
When we think about the treatment, we've been talking about obviously some studies related to risk factors and predictors. We know that Alzheimer's drugs are expensive. Last year, I think it was Aduhelm received accelerated approval by the FDA. It's priced at $56,000 a year, and Medicare limited coverage to patients in clinical trials. And I understand the drug is not selling well, partly because clinicians are not sure that it works. What are your thoughts on this treatment, Dr. Sanders?
Well, I think aducanumab, which is the generic name for Aduhelm, was a paradigm-shifting event in the history of Alzheimer's disease. It was approved as the first disease-modifying medication in Alzheimer's disease. And by the way, it was also the first medication that had been approved for Alzheimer's disease in many, many, many years. There were many issues. It was highly controversial, mm-hmm. partly because that accelerated approval that you mentioned was granted on the basis of what's called an intermediate outcome. And that was the level of amyloid plaque, one of the things that we think causes Alzheimer's disease. So Aduhelm's success was based on the amount of amyloid plaque that it could clear from the brain, not on what happened to any given individual who was taking it. So did it have a cognitive benefit that wasn't required under the approval? So there was much controversy. And as of April of this year, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid in Washington, D.C. have ruled that aducanumab and all of the other monoclonal antibody medications that might come to FDA approval are going to be under the heading of something called coverage with evidence development, which means that they can be prescribed only in the context of a clinical trial. So that's one reason that I cannot at the moment prescribe aducanumab if I wanted to, because I'm not part of my practice is not part of a clinical trial. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in coming years, because there is really a lineup now of new monoclonal antibodies that are coming down the pipeline. And one very promising one has already applied to the FDA for the same kind of accelerated approval that aducanumab or mm-hmm. Aduhelm got last year.
Lisa from Watertown sent in a question and wanted to know, you know, what studies being done regarding effects of prescription drugs, such as for high blood pressure medication, for example, on mental capacity.
I am not myself familiar at this time with any clinical trials that are looking in particular at antihypertensive medications. We do know that people who take beta-blocking drugs, that there can be a cognitive association there, although certainly no level of causality has ever been proven. Now, it may be that there is a trial going on and I'm simply not aware of it. But we do know that certainly managing one's risk factors, and that includes taking, if necessary, medication to control blood pressure, as I do, is an important step for prevention for all of us.
Again, you're hearing Dr. Amir Sanders here on Where We Live, Medical Director of the Hartford Healthcare Memory Care Center. As we talk about new research into Alzheimer's, you can join us 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. One other study that I wanted to highlight before we run out of time, Dr. Sanders, is related to the consumption of ultra-processed food and how that relates to cognitive decline. Can you explain a little bit more about that study?
Yes, this was a big study conducted in Latin America. It enrolled more than 10,000 people, and it separated them into groups according to the proportion of highly processed foods in their diet. Highly processed food, meaning things like very white bread, potato chips, pizza, fast food that you get from, you know, Arby's or Wendy's or McDonald's or a place like that. Convenience foods, also anything that has been processed in order to have a particularly long shelf life, that's an ultra-processed food. So the more that you can back down to the real natural ingredients, cook your own meals, the better off you're going to be. But in this study, they found that individuals who had high consumption of ultra-processed foods faced cognitive decline. And so there were four groups: those who had the most highest consumption of ultra-processed foods, then a little bit less, and then a little bit less, and then the final group was the group that had the least amount of ultra-processed foods in their diet. The three groups that were not the group that had the minimum amount of ultra-processed foods in their diet, all three of those groups experienced global cognitive decline at a rate of 28%. That's quite eye-catching. And then when they looked in particular at what kind of thinking was affected, it was what we call their executive function, which is how we divide our attention. It's how we make decisions. It's what we rely on to get through the day every day. So that was in particular impacted. And the people who had the smallest consumption of ultra-processed foods in their diets did not experience that decline. And boy, did that make me go home and scan my pantry for the good things and perhaps the not so good things. This doesn't mean that you can't go to a cookout and have a hot dog. That's not going to you know, give you Alzheimer's disease later. But overall, dietary mindfulness and trying to eat as much, you know, whole grain and unprocessed food is also a big step that all of us can take toward preventing Alzheimer's disease. Mm.
Before we end, Dr. Sanders, I did want to bring up there was a feature in the magazine Science last month that talked about an investigation into a drug from Cassava Sciences, and Science magazine listed other Alzheimer's drugs, including the one we talked about earlier, Aduhelm, all mired in controversy. Why is there this credibility problem in your view?
Ooh, that's a big question. I think some of the credibility problem with the whole aducanumab, Aduhelm controversy arose from the fact that there was an FDA study group, an advisory group that reviewed the evidence and gave a unanimous sort of thumbs down to the FDA. And usually the FDA follows the advice of such advisory groups. It's not required to. Their advice is not binding. But they, in this instance, they did not. And there were also some concerns about the data because, in fact, the clinical trial for aducanumab was terminated for futility. It didn't meet its outcome measures. And then some secondary analyses were performed, and then a what we call a signal was found. And, you know, some people wonder about whether there was some, you know, a little bit of data manipulation there. I think that has really been studied extensively and that there probably is a signal there. But then there are other controversial issues regarding side effects and that sort of thing. This was the first drug, though. And oftentimes when there's a first drug, it kind of paves the way for other drugs to come along that are ultimately going to be much more successful. That certainly happened with the class of drugs called the cholinesterase inhibitors, on which we rely on a daily basis for the treatment of symptoms along with Alzheimer's disease. Mm. Aducanumab and the other monoclonal antibodies that come along, they actually are attacking the underlying mechanisms, which is why we call them disease-modifying drugs, not symptom-modifying drugs. So, you know, and tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars go into the research to develop one of these medications. And patients certainly are desperate to have them. So there's a lot of pressure on the Alzheimer's community to, you know, let's get it right.
You've been hearing Dr. Amy Sanders, director, medical director of the Hartford Healthcare Memory Care Center, also a medical scientific advisory council member at the Alzheimer's Association Connecticut chapter. A pleasure to hear from you, Dr. Sanders. We hope you come back sometime.
Thank you very much.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk to Dr. Carl Hill from the Alzheimer's Association about new research on how experiencing discrimination and racism increases the risk of memory loss. You can join us too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. During the recent International Alzheimer's Association conference, several studies were released that found living in disadvantaged areas or having low wages put people at greater risk for dementia. There's also new research on how experiencing discrimination and racism increases the risk of memory loss. With us now on Zoom is Dr. Carl Hill, Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer for the Alzheimer's Association. Dr. Hill, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm quoting from the Alzheimer's Association report this year that shows Black people are about twice as likely and Hispanic Latinos are about 1 and 1.5 times as likely to have Alzheimer's or other dementias because of various experiences of structural racism and inequities. Now there's new research comprising nearly 1,000 middle-aged adults that shows racism was associated with lower memory scores, and these associations were driven by Black individuals. So tell us more about this study and your reaction.
I tell you, really, really interesting research presented at the AIC just last week, you know, and so in this particular study, the respondents were able to provide, you know, self-reports of exposure to racism, both interpersonal, you know, that is an individual, you know, treating, you know, them unfairly, and then their perceptions of institutional, you know, racism. And there were reports, you know, there was a relationship that showed lower episodic memory among all ethnicities, but the strongest association among Black African-American participants. And in another study, shared by researchers from the University of California at Davis, a study of almost 500 individuals, including Asian, African-American, Black, Hispanic, Latino, and white respondents, the people age 90 and above, individuals who experience wide-ranging discrimination throughout life had lower memory in late life compared to those who experienced little to no discrimination. So two very insightful and important studies showing the relationship between racism and how it can influence a memory over the life course.
So where do we go from here, Dr. Hill, in terms of the role for policymakers?
Well, first, I think we really have to understand the different types of racism. You know, it's important to know that, you know, institutional racism, you know, lies in unfair policies and discriminatory practices that, you know, institutions uphold, right? And then interpersonal racism is that, you know, when individuals interact with others that, you know, really causes stress, you know, in their lives. The Alzheimer's Association had a special report just last year that found respondents, African-American and Hispanic Latino respondents, reported perceptions of racial discrimination in the dementia care system, right? So if getting a timely and proper diagnosis is, you know, fundamental and so important for all people, if these populations who are disproportionately affected, meaning they're more likely to have Alzheimer's or another dementia, if they perceive that they will be treated unfairly because of their race, they're less likely to engage a neurologist or a dementia care specialist. So it's important that we do all that we can to understand racism, that we include discrimination in our discussions of risk factors for as unique risk factors for these communities and populations. And at the Alzheimer's Association, we're really taking a proactive look at partnering with national and community-based organizations to make sure that we're delivering our resources to communities in a way that's culturally responsible, you know, meaning that we're working with African-American, Hispanic, Latino colleagues to help us to be sure that we're very mindful of our unconscious bias, and we're pursuing health equity in all the ways that are just and that could be effective.
That's important. And when we think about, you know, other ways that people are impacted, even types of trauma someone experiences, maybe a loss of a parent or living in a neighborhood with higher crime rates, you know, how that can impact cognition. What can you tell us, Dr. Hill?
Absolutely. When you think about this, you know, racism is a trauma, you know, that leads to increased stress, you know, and we know can result in biological changes such as inflammation, you know, and Inflammation is a known risk factor for cognitive difficulties, including dementia, right? So, but because of structural racism, which is the combination of a number of factors, you know, it's institutions, it's culture, it's ideology, it's history. You know, people live in communities and neighborhoods, you know, many times because of redlining and, you know, their access to important resources like quality health care that, you know, does not include discrimination really is patterned by this structural racism that has occurred over time, right? And so, you know, because of this structural racism, again, it leads to poor access to quality health care and housing. You know, those who experience interpersonal discrimination are, you know, in the healthcare system, for example, are just not provided a pathway to lower that risk. And this becomes, you know, kind of a 1-2 punch, you know, for populations that experience this type of deprivation. So, you know, researchers should study, you know, continue this study of racism, the different types of racism and how it can be a major contributor to the increased risk, dementia risk for Black and Latino populations.
You've been hearing Dr. Carl Hill, Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer for the Alzheimer's Association. We'll be sure to follow up as, again, this is new research yet published but highlighted at this international conference. We appreciate your time, Dr. Hill.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Sujata Srinivasan with help from talk show intern Mira Raju. Our technical director is Kat Pastor. We'll be back tomorrow.